accession number 20939, Reel 2.
Alec Clark, Reel 2.
I remember when we left the convoy, the next day, the gun on the stern of the ship had to be operated. They had to have a practice with the gun drill. And I'm thinking of the size of the gun. I can't remember the size of the gun. Anyway, they had to fire some shells for practice from the stern of the ship, which they did. The ship, the crew were Indian, Goanese stewards and Lascar men, and on the stern of the ship they had live animals that they kept for their food, sheep and other things. And as a result of the firing of the gun, one of the sheep was at the point of death. And I always remember that these Indians, they had to have a little ceremony over the sheep before they could eat it. It was something to do with their religion. And I felt very sorry for these men, because there was the sheep. It was dying of fright, I suppose. But they had to have a little ceremony, and then that meant that it was they could eat it at their leisure afterwards. I felt very sorry for them. But however, that was only one incident. From there, we went straight on to Cape Town. And we visited all the ports, East London, Durban, Port Elizabeth, Portuguese East Africa, Beira, Lourenco Marques, and then from there we went out to the island of Mauritius. So it was when we went to Durban, when I left home, I had addresses of people from my home village who'd gone abroad after the First World War. So when I went to Durban, I called at a big office called Hunt Lucia's, and I asked for Archie, Bowie I think it was. So he went to see his boss. And so this was a relative of mine, so he got the day off from his work. And he took me up to visit his parents. This was my grandfather's youngest daughter and their big family. So I had a lovely time in Durban, visiting a relative of mine in Durban. And of course, wherever I went, I had addresses of people from my home village who'd gone to Canada, America, Australia, New Zealand. I didn't necessarily visit those places, but if I'd gone to those places, I could have visited somebody from my home village because of the exodus of people from my hometown.
Any other memories of this voyage?
Oh, well now, after we left Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, it was a lovely, very interesting spot to visit, swimming in the warm tropical water, clear of the sharks. We had a special enclosure where we could swim. On the way north, we were due to go to Calcutta to load a cargo of jute, but instead our orders were changed. We had to go to Colombo to load a cargo of tea instead. So that's where we went, to Colombo in Ceylon, as it was known at that time, back through the Suez Canal, Aden, Port Sudan, through the Suez, and back home to Tilbury Docks. And so that's where I was paid off. So I paid off as soon as I came back to Tilbury. And of course, as we went up the channel, that was in May 1940, we could hear the noise of warfare in the distance. It didn't affect us or the convoy. We sailed up the English Channel. That was the only time I never sailed through the channel again after that, because France was overrun, and it was too dangerous for cargo boats to go up that and down that way. So that was my first voyage to South Africa, India, or Ceylon, and then back home again.
Did you sail with the ship?
No. You see, the wireless operators were employed by the Marconi Company, and the shipping company would ask for two operators. So we weren't employed by the company, but by so as soon as we came in, the company paid off the wireless operator, so they didn't have to pay them. See, so that we continued getting paid by the Marconi Company, but that meant that the company didn't have to pay Marconi Company for our services. So they got rid of the operators as quick as possible. That was the first part of the war. That didn't happen afterwards because they were anxious to keep crews and not lose men. But so I reported to the Marconi Depot up in East Ham, East London, And of course, I was entitled to a day's leave for every month's service. So I had barely 4 days leave. So I lived in the north of Scotland. So I didn't have enough leave to travel all the way up to the north of Scotland and go back. It would be time to come back the time I'd got there. So I didn't get any leave. But I didn't mind that. But I always remember I stayed with a nice couple, an elderly couple called Mr. and Mrs. Quick in East Ham. And I stayed the weekend with them. And they were a lovely couple. In fact, Mr. Quick on a Sunday took me up on a tram up to see Westminster, the Houses of Parliament, the Bank of England. And it was lovely that. And then on Monday morning, signed on back to the Marconi Company, and I was appointed to my first ship. The next second ship was the Ball Trader, which was a ship trading up to London. So I didn't mind not going home, because I enjoyed my time in London there.
What kind of a ship was the Ball Trader?
Oh, well, that was the smallest ship that I ever sailed on. It was only 1,500 tonnes. And, of course, in peacetime, it was used for trading to the Baltic countries. So, and the Ball Trader was quite an old ship. It didn't have any fridge. It had an ice box. And, of course, when the ice melted, you had no more cold storage. So you had to use a tin opener and you had no more fresh meat. Once it was used, that was the end of it. So, and of course, the wireless room must have been added sometime after it was built. And the only place, there was a very small boat deck, and the only place they could put the wireless room was at the opposite the galley, at the after end of the midship's accommodation. We were kept continuous watch. I was on from midnight till 6 a.m. I was the second operator, you see. The senior operator had the choice of times. And, of course, I used to watch the cockroaches come in from the galley. But you got used to them after a bit, and you didn't bother killing them anymore, you know. But with the heat of the galley, they thrived quite well there, the cockroaches. So I was on that watch. But I got used to that as well. So, but it was a very old ship. Because everything about it was old, but I have happy memories of the Ball Trader, and my shipmates that I sailed with. Yeah.
What kind of cargoes was it carrying?
Ah, well, now that's interesting, because we had two voyages. One was to Portugal. First time we went to Portimão to load sardines. That's in the south of Portugal, not far from Gibraltar, Portimão. Of course, if we didn't go into harbour, you just dropped the anchor, and the water was fairly calm, and the barges would come out alongside, and the boat used its own derricks and masts to load from the barges into the ship's hold. Then we went to Lisbon. I can't remember what else there was. The second voyage, we nearly all went back again on the Ball Trader, and the second time we went to Cadiz and Seville, quite close to Gibraltar. I can't remember what we loaded in Cadiz, but in Seville, we went up the River Guadalquivir and we loaded casks of sherry. I always remember that, because this was a peacetime cargo, you see. July or August 1940. And of course, as soon as the huge casks of sherry came on the sea, at the docks, there was a military policeman came to guard the casks of sherry. Somehow or another, the sherry used to find its way into the containers on board the Ball Trader, and I think there was a liberal supply of what was available from the casks of sherry. Don't ask me why, but... and of course, not only that, in Spain, after the Civil War, you see, there was no... Captain had no... There was no agent there. No money was given out because we had no contacts with the Spanish authorities, except the captain had with somebody. So the men had no money. So what did they do? Well, they sold ship stores and got money in that way. In fact, the mate of the ship, I believe he was responsible for, there was a tow rope went ashore onto a truck, And I think that was sold. And some of the officers and men, they went ashore, had a good time, because they sold things on board ship to get the pesetas and the money to, so they could go to the bullfights, you know, participate in all the other things that was available. Some of them had a good time. I didn't go very far. I didn't go to the centre of the ship. Some of them had a grand time there, I can tell you. And then through the cask of sherry, I think there was lemons. I remember the sherry. There was other things as well. Onions, lemons, a number of things loaded in Seville. Of course, being a small ship, they could go up into that estuary, you see, the Guadalquivir. Went back to Gibraltar. And I was there in Gibraltar when the Vichy French planes bombed Gibraltar. That was in the summer of 1940. And the British Navy had been attacking the Vichy French fleet, trying to sink them. And so this was a retaliation. And of course, so the planes came over, and the Ark Royal was in port at that time. He got up steam and quickly left port like a shot. And none of the bombs hit any of the ships. There was a large lot of ships in Algeciras Bay. But one of the Greek ships, they took to the lifeboats and rowed right across to the Spanish coast to get away from the bombing. But what happened was the bombs stunned a lot of the fish in Algeciras Bay. And the lovely fish, as they drifted down past the ship, we were able to pick the fish up and take them on board. So we got lovely fresh fish for some time from the bombing that resulted in the Algeciras Bay. But that was only a passing incident. And then, on the way home, by this time, of course, we couldn't go up the English Channel. So when the ships were coming in from Spain and Portugal, they had to go out around the coast of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And it was very bad weather. It was October or November. And the ship I was on was a very slow one. So we lost the convoy. So one morning, it must have been about 7:30 or thereabouts, the whistle, the mate was on charge. He was on duty at 4 to 8 watch. And he blew the ship's whistle. So we knew there was something amiss. Everybody got belting up quick as anything. And there was a German plane. He came at us and he dropped a couple of bombs. But he was such a hurry to get us, he missed us. And of course, as soon as the bombs went off, we knew what it was. And this German plane, I don't know which make or kind it was, it went round with a circle and came at us with a cannon in the nose of the plane. And as I was dashing along the alleyway to get to the wireless room, I could see the flashes of this cannon shell firing at us. And so I went to the wireless room, and the senior operator says, go up to the bridge to get the ship's position. So I went up to the bridge, and of course the second mate was busy with a pair of calipers and fiddling about to get the ship's position. So he says, that's the position. So I went down to the wireless room, and we had an old-fashioned spark transmitter. They're not used nowadays, but the senior operator, he started up the motor and pressed the key, and anyway, we had to fumble about to make contact with the spark gaps. And anyway, he sent off the message, being attacked by enemy aircraft, gave the number, position. And of course, the convoy heard us transmitting, and the destroyer went to find out where we were. Went to this location, this place, but we weren't there, because the position wasn't 100% right. But he found us eventually, and that night we were directed back to the convoy. When we got back to our cabin, I shared a cabin with the third mate. He was a Londoner, a nice lad. And there was a cannon shell had gone through the roof of our cabin and knocked a big hole in the deck. And he'd had a pair of shots over the rail of his bed. He was very annoyed that this cannon had partly destroyed his pair of shots. And all over the cabin there was bits of shrapnel pitted into the wall. And of course, we collected all these bits together and we decided, well, you'll have this half and I'll have the other half. And you could see the letters centimetres. But of course, as the ship was lost in the end, we lost everything that was on it anyway. That ship was eventually blown up by an acoustic mine at the Thames, in the Barrow Deeps, as you come into the River Thames, the Thames estuary.
Were you on the ship at the
yes,
time?
Yes, yes, oh yes.
Can you describe what happened to you?
Yes, it was a Saturday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, and we were the last ship in the convoy. You see, you were in columns, and of course, a ship could go over one of these mines and it wouldn't necessarily detonate. But so many ships would go over it, and then say at a particular number, the thing would activate. Well, we were the last ship in the convoy on this column, and we must have gone over this mine. And they, as I say, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There was one big bang, so we knew what we had to do. I was in the cabin with a third mate, so we grabbed our life jackets, grabbed a jacket and a life jacket, and up onto the boat deck. And there was two lifeboats, the starboard and the port. For some reason or another, the starboard lifeboat couldn't be launched. So, but the one on the port side could easily be. So everybody got into that, and you lowered the davits swing out, and then you lower it gently into the water. It was a fine day, and we went into the water, so that was okay. And we were just about to push off when there was another man, I think he was the donkey man, he'd gathered up a whole lot of clothes from the forret accommodation section, and he came onto the boat deck, and the captain had a few strong words to say to him, "Get down here quick." So he did. But there was a shower of shirts and jackets and all sorts of things. But he got down into the boat anyway. So, but of course, our business was to get away from the boat as quick as possible, because you didn't know what was going to happen. Unfortunately, two of the men were sitting on the stern of the ship, and that was where the explosion occurred. And the stern of the ship was blown off. And these two men, we never saw them again. One was an ordinary seaman, and one was a carpenter, called him Chippy, and there's two Londoners, and they were lost. We never saw them again. They were killed in the explosion. But of course, the rest of us got off on the boat, on the lifeboat, and then we were picked up by a drifter patrolling nearby, taken into Southend Pier about 5 or 6 o'clock that evening.
What's a donkey man?
It's a job in the engine room. I don't know if that's the oiling of certain... See, it was a reciprocating engine, and certain things have to be oiled periodically. I couldn't tell you all the jobs that a donkeyman has to do, but I would call him an odd job man. You know, certain jobs have to be done in the engine room to do with oil and mucky things. So they were dressed accordingly for their working in the engine room.
This appears to have been the 8th of July, 1940.
No. This was nearly, this was about the 9th of November.
Oh, no, sorry, it was the 11th of November.
Yeah, that's right. Well, now, you see, we paid off on the Monday. 2 days before that was the Saturday. When we were landed at Southend Pier, we were taken to a hotel where we could stay. That was on the Saturday. The senior operator got a bottle of champagne, and we drank our health for our safe arrival back on shore. And on the Sunday, we were taken to a barber's to get a shave. And that's the only time I was ever shaved with a cutthroat razor. Never again allow this to happen to me. God, it was terrible. And that was on the Sunday. On the Monday, we went up to the Dock Street shipping office in London, and we paid off as if nothing had happened. See? You just paid off, and nobody said anything about what had happened. But as far as officially, the ship paid off. But of course, not only that, we got some clothes. You see, I had my uniform jacket. I don't think I had my cap. I got a civilian grey. I had a civilian coat to put on. So I got some and had a little attaché case, a little for a minimum of belongings. So I went to the Marconi Company. Reported, the two of us, and so I had my leave, and the senior operator, now where did he come from? I can't remember where he came from. But anyway, I sent those telegrams, and I sent a telegram saying that I'd be coming home at a certain time, a certain train. And my father always came up to meet me to give me a hand with my luggage. See, when I got to the Portesi station, he says, "Where's your luggage?" "Oh," I says, "the bottom of the sea." "Oh, man," he says. So, that because the ship was lost, it meant that I got a fortnight's sick leave, a fortnight's leave after the shipwreck, and I also had the sum of £40 That was to buy clothes to get myself ready for going back to sea again. So that's what happened. In addition to my leave, it was obtained in the course of a day a month. I had a fortnight's leave. So I got a nice long leave, and I had £40 to spend to buy clothes to fit me out for the next job. So that was but I was sorry about the two men that were lost, you know, that was very sad. And the ball trader. And they were all Londoners. They were nearly home, see. And those two didn't quite make it.
What's happened next?
Oh, the next ship I was on was an oil tanker called the Empire Diplomat. And that was a British tanker, but it was taken over by the Navy, so it was called Empire Diplomat, and it was called Royal Fleet Auxiliary, RFA, and it flew the blue ensign. So it was an oil depot ship. Oh, we did. I joined in Grangemouth, I think it was, on the 1st of 4th. We went down to the Thames Estuary, and we were anchored there for a while. And we were there when the bombing raids were in London. You know, there was a lot of the fire raids in London. We used to hear the German planes going over at night time. And not only so, but the Germans were dropping mines in the estuary of the Thames. And I can remember when five ships went up with explosions one morning. And one of them was a tanker that burned for 3 days in the Thames estuary. Anyway, we were heaving up anchor one day, and there was a parachute on the anchor cable. So the mate told the captain. The captain phoned, signalled the South End Pier, which was like a naval watchtower, about this. They said, oh, drop your anchor and drift away clear, because we didn't know whether there was a mine on the end, but it could have been. So we drifted clear and left that spot. And so that was probably a parachute or a mine that was attached to the anchor cable, but didn't affect us. Anyway, from the River Thames, we went up to Newcastle, and that was the time that a whole lot of guns were put on the oil tanker. We were more or less, not much armament, but there was Oerlikon guns, fore, aft, everywhere. The tanker was put specially fitted out for war, as you might say. And so, but after that time, of all places, we went to Kyle of Lochalsh on the west coast of Scotland. And I was there for more than a year on an oil depot ship. That was a mine-laying base during the war. And the ship that I was on, this tanker, would supply the destroyers and other craft that would come in, oil fuel. But the ship wasn't doing very much. We were all heavily armed, but we never needed the armament because we were in one of the safe locks on the west coast of Scotland. It was a navy base during the war, of course, and ashore there was a cinema, a naffy, and a little bit of activity for the men to go ashore on the Liberty boat. I lost all my study books on the previous ship, so I was anxious to make new notes for my wireless certificate. So I had a bit of study to do. So I got on with that, and eventually I sat my next certificate. But I had quite a bit of study to do to write out my notes that I'd lost in the previous ship. And so I made the best of it. And of course, I wasn't far from home on the Kyle of Lochalsh. I just used to get the train to Inverness and home to Bucky. So I was nearer home than a lot of the other chaps came from the south of England. So I made the best of my time on the Empire Diplomat.
Was it a boring time at Kyle of Lochalsh?
Well, I suppose it was in a way, but you had your pals on board ship. You know, you made the best of your friendship with your pals. You'd play cards and you read books and you went ashore. In fact, after the war, the third engineer, Sidney Woods, he married one of the local girls, Elspeth McRae. And I knew we used to visit this home occasionally. And funnily enough, it wasn't until after the war that I was so quite surprised that Sidney Woods, a very quiet chap from Tunbridge Wells, and he married this girl, Elspeth McRae. I always remember that. But I found that out after the war when I wrote to them. But I paid off for that ship. and join another ship after that time.
So it appears you were at Kyle of Lochalsh about 41, 42.
That's right, yes. Yeah, that's right. And it was a very dangerous time at sea. You know, one of the fifth engineer, a chap called Edgar from Whitley Bay, he got fed up with it. And he was paid off, and he joined a ship going deep sea. He was lost the next voyage. That was Edgar, nice lad. But you see, anything could have happened at that time, but that was one of the worst times of the danger of U-boat attack and those sort of things. So, I mean, I put up with it. I made the best of it. And as I say, I was interested in wireless, of course, and building wireless sets, you know, and it was my hobby as well as my job, the wireless. So I was very interested in wireless at that time.
And so you said that you then went to another ship?
Yeah. Now, after the Empire Diplomat, no.
I think it was the Ethel Regent.
Ah, well, now that's an interesting one. I joined in Glasgow on the Firth of Clyde, and that one became the Commodore ship of the convoy UC-1. And that was the name of the convoy, and it was essentially a tanker convoy going up to Curaçao in the Dutch West Indies. The tankers were empty, or in what they call in ballast. And on that occasion, that's the only time then that we went out through the Bristol Channel and out along the south coast of Ireland, out into the Atlantic. And it wasn't until we were off the Azores that the U-boats found the convoy. And so there was all the U-boat packs, there was 13 U-boats sent to attack this convoy. And it was in February of 43, that's right. And so this one night, late one afternoon, the leading convoy escort sent the commodore of the convoy a message saying, 8 submarines shadowing the convoy. So we knew that there was going to be trouble. We guessed that there was going to be trouble. These submarines had come up on the starboard side when it was pitch dark, and some of them got in ahead of the convoy. And as a result of the U-boat attack, one had been sunk earlier. That was the Athol Princess. The Empire Norseman was sunk, and an American ship called the Esso Baton Rouge. And the Esso Baton Rouge was just behind our ship, the Athol Regent. And I remember when that ship was blown up by a torpedo, and the torpedo hit the oil fuel tank, and it went on a blaze. So some of the men were killed on that ship, and a lot of injuries. People were badly burned on the Esso Baton Rouge. There was 2 ships hit. One was the Marina and the British Fortitude, but they still remained afloat and they were able to continue with the convoy. So out of that U-boat attack, there was 3 ships sunk and 2 damaged, but we were well covered by escort, American and British escort vessels, and they managed to keep them at bay. And so that was the only major submarine attack that I was participated in during the war, you know. And of course, I learned much more about it after the war when I was in touch with chaps who were able to tell me of their experiences. So I was able to make a little story of that.
How frightened were you in the Athol Regent?
Not really. I wasn't frightened at all. For instance, when the first submarine fired its torpedo at some of the ships, it must have fired a whole lot of torpedoes, only some hit. I shared a cabin with the third operator right underneath the wireless room, and the senior operator was in charge. He was on watch between the 4 to 8 watch. And he was banging on the floor like this. So I thought, what's up? So I went shooting upstairs onto the bridge into the wireless room, and I think he was more scared than I was. And he said, well, the ships have been hit with torpedoes. Oh, yes. So I stayed with him for a while, but there's nothing much I could do. So once it had died down a bit, I just came down. There was no good me being there. And of course, And coming down, I saw the Esobata Grouge, which had gone up in a blaze, and I knew ships had been hit. But it becomes so much a part of your everyday life that I wasn't afraid of any or anything of that sort. Afterwards, when I dashed up to the wireless room, I thought I saw.